Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth and productivity of Florida depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust encourages all businesses to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital staff members. More information is at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
The incoming Florida House Speaker vows to change the way business is done in his chamber, and that's raising more than a few eyebrows around the state capitol.
At the end of the day, we're the enemies. We're the problem. The only reason they have power is because we voluntarily abdicate and give to them what is rightfully ours, and what is rightfully ours belongs to the people.
Also this week, state officials are making daily updates about the Mosaic sinkhole spill now, but one U.S. representative is concerned about a lack of communication right after the spill.
I am very concerned that the first response to this was to not alert those that were closest to the sinkhole spill.
We'll also see how the newly passed Florida medical marijuana amendment might be put in place, learn how some nursing homes are upset about how much or how little they'll be paid for Medicaid patients, and go on a trek to save some endangered species in Florida. I'm Tom Flanagan. This is Capitol Report. Florida lawmakers will be back in Tallahassee next Tuesday for an organization session. There are many newbies on both sides of the Capitol, including 20 new senators and 46 new House members. In a tradition seemingly as old as the Florida swamps, the leadership changes every 2 years in both chambers of the state legislature. Usually, that transition is accomplished without too much muss and fuss, but sometimes that isn't the case. And this may be just one of those very cases. House Speaker-designate Richard Corcoran, a Land O'Lakes Republican, is an unstoppable force about to meet an immovable object. Corcoran is vowing to rein in lobbyists and change the budget writing process. And as Jim Ash reports, sparks are flying a week before his official swearing in.
Dave Mica and Richard Corcoran would seem to have a lot in common. Mica is an influential lobbyist whose brother, Congressman John Mica, is a powerful politician. Richard Corcoran is a powerful politician whose brother, Michael Corcoran, is an influential lobbyist. But when Dave Mica, the Tallahassee lobbyist, wrote to Speaker-designate Richard Corcoran and offered to help write new lobbying rules, the two didn't see eye to eye. Corcoran didn't even feel obliged to write back.
If Dave Mica wants to sit at the table and have input, there's a process. It's called an election.
If anything, lobbyists and lawmakers have been too eager to work together, the speaker-designate told reporters this week.
At the end of the day, we're the enemies. We're the problem. The only reason they have power is because we voluntarily abdicate and give to them what is rightfully ours, and what is rightfully ours belongs to the people.
The House is expected to approve the changes in an organizational session next week, and they would be the toughest since a 2005 gift ban. One change would beef up revolving door restrictions and make lawmakers wait even longer after leaving office before lobbying their old colleagues. Lobbyists wouldn't be able to text lawmakers during committee meetings and floor sessions, and they would have to publicly document the bills and budget items they're targeting. Freshman Representative Russell Barrington of Lauderdale Lakes speaks for most Democrats when he praises the reforms.
One of the reasons we have all of these typhoons and hurricanes in the political process is that transparency has not been up to par. And I think it's incumbent upon us, who are given this privilege, this opportunity to serve our people, to be sure that what we do is in keeping with basic, standard, decent procedures.
Lobbyists went to court to fight the gift ban and lost. Dave Mica says it's too early to know whether his group, the Florida Association of Professional Lobbyists, will file a lawsuit. Corcoran isn't stopping with lobbyists. He wants to ban House members from quietly slipping spending items into the budget at the last minute. Instead, they would have to file local projects as separate bills. Incoming Senate President Joe Negron, a Stewart Republican, has given Corcoran's proposal a cool reception.
You know, I'm the one that got the public right to speak bill passed so that the public can be heard. So I think that we share a commitment to an open and transparent process, and we have to figure out the best way to do it.
Corcoran is no fan of compromise. He preferred blowing up a session in 2014 and going home early when the Senate insisted on expanding Medicaid. Orlando Democrat Linda Stewart was just elected to the Senate, but she was serving in the House when the meltdown happened. she sees another potential train wreck.
Two different approaches to the budget, two different approaches to workman's comp, to the environment, to how you might be able to allocate your funds on behalf of your district. There's a lot that is going to be quite different.
But newly elected Republican Senator Dennis Baxley of Ocala isn't worried. A veteran House member, Baxley says it always works out in the end.
Well, it's always a great discussion, and this is how 20 million people have a discussion.
For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jim Ash.
State regulators are assuring Floridians their drinking water is safe in the wake of a sinkhole at a Polk County fertilizer plant. But Nick Evans reports the agency's response is raising other concerns.
In late August, the sinkhole opened up at Mosaic's New Wales facility in Polk County. It happened in what's known as a gypsum stack, a steadily growing hill of waste material left over from the fertilizer production process. Florida's bedrock is porous, and over time, those stacks can become too heavy for the limestone to support. Now Democratic Congresswoman Gwen Graham is taking aim at the Department of Environmental Protection's response in the days immediately following the spill.
I am very concerned that the first response to this was to not alert those that were closest to the sinkhole spill. That should have been done immediately after Mosaic notified DEP.
Graham is considering a run for governor in 2018, and her office filed a public records request shortly after the spill became public knowledge. Despite Mosaic notifying the department of the sinkhole on August 28th, the first time it shows up in agency emails is September 15th. A request for an interview with the DEP spokesperson about the apparent gap in communication was not returned by this story's deadline.
We have an obligation to the people of Florida, and the people of Florida were not put first in terms of their response, and these public records are just confirm what my worst concerns were, which is that the actions that they were taking did not show the urgency of the situation.
Mosaic and state regulators are scrambling, pumping out dangerous water and testing local wells. In its daily updates on the spill, the department notes there is still no evidence of the spill moving off-site, threatening drinking water supplies, or contaminating the Floridan aquifer. But that's not the agency's only response.
The rule includes the specific notification requirements that need to be submitted. These include the names and addresses of the person contacting the department, the substances that has been released, estimated quantities.
Stephanie Gudeman is a program director with the department, and she's describing a new pollution notification rule in development right now. But some industrial interests have argued the regulation is too broad, and that concern came up at a meeting of the Pinellas County Legislative Delegation. Here's Clearwater Republican Senator Jack Latvala.
The specific question that I have is there a size of the spill that triggers the rule?
Ryan Matthews, the deputy secretary with the department, pointed out the original rule didn't have a cutoff, but the agency has since updated it.
There were no limitations, no thresholds for what a pollution incident is. Is it a 5-gallon gas tank? Is it a can of paint that you spill in your driveway? What the new rule states that if you are an owner of an installation, a wastewater treatment facility, an installation is defined in statute, and you have a spill or an incident that meets certain thresholds. Those thresholds are if it's a reportable incident to the state watch office. So there are clearly defined thresholds within that rule that show you what needs to be notified.
Those updates shift the focus of the rule to larger facilities and spills. The department filed the changes on November 15th, which means the final rule can go into effect as early as December 6th. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
Still to come on Capitol Report, Florida voters passed a constitutional amendment approving medical marijuana earlier this month. Now what? And would it really impact anyone?
It would be many, many, many thousands of patients. Tens of thousands of patients. I mean, it's a lot.
Florida is contemplating a new rate structure for Medicaid payments to nursing homes, and some of those homes are raising a major stink about the proposed changes.
The care you receive at a 5-star Gold Seal nursing home isn't the same as the care you receive at a 1-star community. It just can't be.
How do you save endangered critters? A new imperiled species management plan for Florida may set up a framework for restoring dwindling populations.
Previously, Florida's state list of imperiled species was really just that, it was a list.
And can putting a financial literacy class to a hard rock beat make the message more convincing to a high school audience?
Because I think a lot of people like our age don't really pay attention to that at all until it's too late.
The second time was the charm this year as Florida voters approved a constitutional amendment legalizing medical marijuana in the state. But don't expect the state's doctors to start issuing prescriptions just yet. From Health News Florida, Abe Abaraya takes a look at what happens next.
Juan Cruz is a smartly dressed 15-year-old Deltona boy, black ball cap, bow tie, jeans, and sneakers. He's sitting on a comfy leather couch as he's handed a blue bag with his latest prescription. An orange-flavored medical marijuana spray with THC.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, baby, under your tongue.
The right side of Juan's face is red and swollen. Beneath the skin, you can see the tumor Juan's been battling for 2 years. He wears a patch after his right eye was removed. He's on hospice, and he has a continuous morphine drip. His mother, Jackie, now hopes trying marijuana will let him be weaned off the morphine in what she calls a pharmacy in their bathroom.
He's a strong kid. He's been the strongest kid I've ever known.
Cruz is able to get medical marijuana with THC under an existing Florida law that allows the terminally ill to get euphoric medical marijuana. With Florida recently approving Amendment 2, more patients will be able to access medical marijuana. The list of 10 qualifying conditions now includes cancer, HIV/AIDS, and multiple sclerosis. Dr. Joseph Rosado prescribed Juan medical marijuana. He's been an advocate of Florida's medical marijuana amendment.
As I mentioned earlier, one more tool in my toolbox to be able to manage and address patients, and not only limited to the 4 or 5 diagnoses that we presently have, but broader.
Jerry Greenspoon's Fort Lauderdale law firm has its own cannabis law practice. He says the Greenspoon Martyr firm has been fielding calls from clients since election night.
And are calling to request, okay, what do we do now? Of course, our answer at this point is nothing. Just wait.
Advocates estimate that 400,000 to 500,000 Floridians could be eligible for medical marijuana. But before those patients can get marijuana, Florida's legislature has to act. They start meeting in March, and there are deadlines. By June, they need to get a law passed and implemented by the Florida Department of Health. And Florida must start issuing medical marijuana cards by September. Attorney Jerry Greenspoon says in order to reach the size of the market in Florida,
You need quite a few outlets and dispensaries to be open and available. You need quite a bit of product. You need quite a few manufacturing facilities. Far, far, far in excess of 6. That's impossible.
There are 6 dispensaries already growing cannabis in Florida. This will be the third time the Florida legislature tackles medical marijuana, so the process could go faster than in years past. But that doesn't mean that there won't be fights. Jessica Spencer was the policy director for Drug-Free Florida during its campaign against medical marijuana. She wants the legislature to regulate the amount of THC available in the drug, and she wants to make sure it doesn't come in candy form. And she wants local governments to be able to regulate where the dispensaries can go.
And we need to make sure that we help the legislature strictly regulate this to make sure that this does not get in the hands of our children and people that do not need it.
And the nurseries already licensed to grow could create another roadblock. Bruce Knox of Knox Nurseries has one of those licenses. He's worried that if the legislature adds more, he'll lose his competitive advantage. He says he built his Central Florida nursery with room to grow, anticipating the number of patients Amendment 2 could serve.
It would be many, many, many thousands of patients, tens of thousands of patients. I mean, it's a lot.
He says how Florida implements the law is the million-dollar question, but it may be the $1.5 billion question. By one estimate, that's the dollar value of Florida's legal marijuana sales by 2020. For Health News Florida, I'm Abe Abaraya in Orlando.
Florida's unemployment rate ticked up slightly to 4.8% in October. That translates to about 473,000 Floridians out of work. That's according to numbers released today by the State Department of Economic Opportunity. The rate was up from 4.7% in September, but was below the 5.1% rate in October a year ago. The national unemployment rate in October was just 0.2 percentage points higher than Florida's. Monroe County had the lowest rate in the state, while Hendry County had the highest rate. Nursing homes are gearing up to fight a plan that could result in some being paid more and others less under the state's Medicaid program. Lynn Hatter reports it's part of a legislative push to reduce costs and streamline payments under Medicaid, but the move is also creating worry among providers.
Most people will have some interaction with a nursing home, whether it's personally or through a friend or a family member. And Florida has one of the largest population of seniors, making it a graying state. That, says Tony Parker, is why people should be paying attention to a looming fight over Medicaid reimbursement rates to nursing homes.
Large parts of this state will eventually need nursing facility care. You know, you want to make sure that they are being adequately reimbursed so they can provide good quality service to you when you're in there or to a family member, and that the citizens of Florida receive good quality care when they're in our nursing homes.
Parker oversees Medicaid payments for the Florida Healthcare Association. It represents nearly 80% of the state's nursing care facilities. Some of those homes depend on Medicaid, the healthcare program for the poor, while others not so much. And there's growing discord over a plan by the Agency for Healthcare Administration to create a so-called quality-based payment structure. Steve Ballmer heads Leading Age Florida.
The care you receive at a five-star Gold Seal nursing home isn't the same as the care you receive at a one-star community. It just can't be. Different settings, different levels of nursing staffing, the numbers of nurses that are available, quality of activities programs, quality of food. Mm-hmm. The idea that you would treat those as the same and pay the same for them just doesn't make any sense.
The payment scheme, as envisioned, would take existing Medicaid dollars and redistribute them, resulting in some nursing homes getting more and others getting less. The state is forging ahead with a one-size-fits-all model. The proposed payment system is aimed at curbing retroactive payments to nursing homes at a time when Florida lawmakers are trying to decrease the cost of Medicaid, the single largest program in the state budget. Every year, nursing homes are audited, and those that are overpaid have to return the money, with those that were underfunded getting reimbursed. Ballmer says the state could just eliminate the retroactive payments altogether.
Freeze rates right where they are today. Don't pay any more or any less than what we paid today. Eliminate those lookbacks and use that as the rate going forward. Problem solved.
Which means what you get is what you get.
Unless the legislature decides to raise what you get down the road at some point. Exactly right. See, it's that simple.
Except it's not that simple, says the FHCA's Parker.
You want to make sure that you are, in fact, paying people what their actual costs are. So you have to do that audit. You have to work through and say, okay, they submitted a cost report that said their rate was $240. We want to verify that that is, in fact, what they are spending. So I think to stay in the current cost-based system and to get rid of the retroactive process is just not feasible.
So, while most nursing homes agree changes should be made, there's widespread disagreement on how to do it. The conversation comes as the state is underfunding nursing home care by about $150 million a year. Florida lawmakers are expecting a tight budget, and the FHCA's Parker expects Florida lawmakers to begin debating the issue but not settle it this upcoming legislative session.
If the industry can get together and you know, folks can compromise and come to some sort of agreement on some things that we can all kind of give a little bit on, I think there's a good chance that it happens. If it's something that it's going to be very complicated and very, you know, there's a lot of division within the industry on it. You know, as we both know, they've got a lot of important issues they have to tackle this year in session. And I don't know where nursing home payments rank on that list. I think they're probably down a few spots.
Or maybe not. Incoming House Speaker Richard Corcoran has said health care and education cuts will not be off the table. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Len Hatter.
After years of work, Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission members have passed an imperiled species management plan. Regan McCarthy has more.
The Imperiled Species Management Plan addresses the conservation needs of 57 Florida species, including the Sherman fox squirrel, one of Commission Chair Brian Yablonsky's favorites.
But I thought we had ferrets in Florida when I first saw a fox squirrel. I said, because they're the most curious animals. They won't run from you. They'll just kind of get up on a fence and look at you and stare you down. And
other species covered under the plan include the Everglades mink, the white-crowned pigeon, the key ringneck snake, the Florida Keys mole skink, the rimrock crowned snake, and the Florida brown snake. Commissioners approved guidelines for all 8 of those species Wednesday. Commission staff is working to develop guidelines for the remaining species. Commissioner Ron Bergeron says while animals like bears and panthers tend to get the most public attention in Florida, the list is made up of a number of lesser-known species.
These are also very important, many of species of which a lot of us, like me, didn't even recognize that they existed in Florida.
But Bergeron says even though they're lesser known, those species play an important role in the state. Meanwhile, environmentalists are celebrating the plan. Julie Rathmel is the Deputy Executive Director of Audubon Florida.
Previously, Florida's state list of imperiled species was really just that. It was a list.
Rathmel says previously a species might be named to the list, but officials had no framework for taking action to manage that species. She says the new management plan addresses that.
There really wasn't a recipe there for how these species were going to get across that finish line, which of course was frustrating to conservationists and was also frustrating to landowners because they couldn't see where there was an end in sight and where there was hope for those species to eventually be recovered and brought off the list. That's why I think this is really so exciting. We now have that recipe, that manual for how we're going to bring these species back.
Rathmel says another good thing about the plan is that it required stakeholders like environmentalists and landowners to work together and has created a sense of teamwork and opened the lines of communication between the two groups. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Almost exactly 5 years after Florida A&M University drum major Robert Champion died of injuries suffered in a hazing incident, a state appeals court today upheld the manslaughter and hazing convictions of another former member of the school's Marching 100 band. A 3-judge panel of the 5th District Court of Appeal in a 16-page ruling rejected arguments by attorneys for Dante Martin that Florida's hazing law is overbroad and that a circuit judge made a series of errors, such as refusing to exclude autopsy photos from the trial. Martin, who's now 29, was found guilty of manslaughter, felony hazing resulting in death, and 2 counts of misdemeanor hazing in the November 19, 2011 death of Champion, who was injured in Orlando during a ritual known as Crossing Bus C. During the ritual, band members were struck repeatedly as they crossed from the front of the bus to the back, and Martin was the president of Bus C. Martin was sentenced to 77 months in prison after being found guilty by an Orange County jury and is an inmate at the Wakulla Work Camp, according to information on the State Department of Corrections website. Champion's death came during the annual Florida Classic weekend, which includes a football game between Florida A&M and Bethune-Cookman University. This year's Florida Classic will be played tomorrow in Orlando. Finally this week, the number of states that require high school students to take an economics course has dropped in recent years, but in Florida, financial education appears to be more of a priority. As Kathy Carter reports, it's not only a graduation requirement, but public schools also must teach kids about personal finance.
If you're giving a PowerPoint presentation to hundreds of teenagers and the focus is on financial literacy, you might want to consider booking a rock band as the opening act.
Thank you for being here, people.
Turns out, things like compounding interest and the perils of payday loans seem much cooler when the guy talking about it wears a black leather jacket and plays guitar. And the rock star to do just that on a recent morning at St. Petersburg High School goes by one name, Gooding, the same name as his band. Gooding's philosophy, music makes the medicine go down. So after playing a short set, the musician talks to kids from 5 area high schools about making smart financial decisions. And yes, he knows how that sounds.
People ask me, they're like, do you write songs about financial literacy? Do you sing about credit cards? I'm like, oh my God, I don't want to hear that band. That band should break up immediately. No.
Gooding admits that his band experienced their own financial struggles early on in their career. But after years of driving beat-up vans to the next gig and cooking ramen noodles in motel coffee pots, Gooding has learned a thing or two about money management and diversification. The band has earned extra money by licensing their music for advertising and to TV shows from CSI to Scandal. That's how they've managed to become something of a small business. In St. Pete, Gooding shared stories of celebrities and sports stars who lost fortunes. He talked about how credit scores work, and he took questions from the audience.
What's the difference between a savings account and the retirement account?
Right now, the savings account is not going to get you a lot of money back. It's still a great thing to have because it puts a brick wall between you and your money. An individual retirement account, or an IRA, is a much better return.
There's a lot of attention paid to the concept that you're never too young to start saving. Even with other responsibilities like paying off student debt or saving up for a home, some money should go towards a retirement account. Gooding's example, if an 18-year-old saves $50 a week, on average they will have over $600,000 by the time they're 65. That seemed to resonate with Samantha Lee, a senior at Northeast High School in St. Petersburg.
Because I think a lot of people like our age don't really pay attention to that at all until it's too late. So I think it's very important to start now, which is their overall message. So I think that's like awesome to start now.
But you can't save if you spend. And that can be hard to resist for teenagers constantly bombarded by advertising. And next year, when some of these kids head to college, they'll face another temptation. Credit cards. According to the U.S. Department of Education, 41% of college seniors had credit card debt with an average balance of just over $3,000.
The first credit card company that you sign with is more than likely going to be the one that you stick with, and they really target teenagers for that reason.
That's Hannah Taylor, another Northeast High School senior. She and Samantha Lee are part of the school's Academy of Finance, a series of college prep classes for students looking for a career in business. Debbie Fisher is the program's director. She says financial literacy is especially important for students that have seen the consequences of what happens when families have to live paycheck to paycheck.
And so for these kids, we want them to understand this is how you get out of that situation. This is what's going to get you to that next level. This is how to complete tax forms, and this is what to do with your paycheck, and this is how to plan for your future.
After Gooding wraps up the presentation, he brings the band back on stage for one last song. By now, most of the kids are on their feet, and plenty others are clutching Gooding posters, along with flyers, on how to customize a savings plan.
Thank you, guys. Be safe.
I'm Kathy Carter in Tampa.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida public radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Ken Smith, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at @FPRCapReport. And please join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: The Able Trust, 25 years of connecting businesses with workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to interview and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. AbleTrust.org. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.